My talk today is on privatizing stuff, and my motto is, if it moves, privatize it. If it doesn't move, privatize it. And since everything either moves or doesn't move, privatize everything. There are some cartoons that have been drawn by students in previous sessions. If you think that public goods are a good idea, I have a bridge to sell you. Maybe you can make it work. That was a cartoon written by a previous student at this seminar. Here's another one. Why did the chicken cross the road? I have no idea, but we must privatize that road. Another line is, I'm going to write a 60-page paper refuting the chicken point by point. Another one is, I'm going to co-author a paper with the chicken. These are all teases at me because I co-author a lot of papers with a lot of people, and a lot of my papers are refutations of someone else point by point. Okay, so what is the general case for privatization? The way I see it, the general case for privatization is two, utilitarian and deontological. Utilitarian, Hazlitt tells us that there's a weeding out process. The reason we have pretty good shirts and ties and wristwatches and eyeglasses and shoes and other things is because of the weeding out process, that if you do a good job as an entrepreneur, you'll make profits and be able to expand your base of operation. If you do a bad job, you're going to lose money, and eventually you'll go bankrupt if you don't change the error of your ways. So there's a continual reward and penalty, carrot and stick situation in the market that doesn't apply in the case of the government. In the case of the government, if a bureaucrat does a good job, and it's possible that he would, he doesn't keep the money unless there's graft or something. And if he does a bad job, usually they increase the budget. And you have to wait for 4 years to turn out the rascals. And government is very inefficient. I don't think I have to belabor that point in this audience. The second one is a second utilitarian point is the point that Mises makes about socialism. When things are not private, especially means of production, there's no free price system, and without a price system that indicates scarcity and desire of goods, you can't centrally plan. You're planning irrationally, like with the, I don't know, a mask over your head. You can't see the economy without prices. So that would be the utilitarian case. The deontological or ethical case would be that if it's private, it's voluntary. You buy and you sell, there's no coercion. Whereas if it's funneled through the government, they compel you to pay taxes to support it. And compulsion is, you know, unethical. Okay, so that's the general case for privatization. And now I want to apply it to roads, highways, streets, and I think toward the end I'll try to apply it to water, rivers, lakes, oceans, things like that. But most of it will be on roads because I've done a book on this, and I'm just starting my stuff on water privatization, so I don't have as much on that. Why be so radical? Why not stick to privatizing mines like Margaret Thatcher did in Britain, or factories like they did in the Soviet Union, or the post office, which some people try to, you know, there is a move among libertarians and Austrians to try to privatize the post office. Housing, you know, Margaret Thatcher also privatized the council housing or public housing. These are all good things, and I urge people to get involved in privatization of those things. But to me, you want to apply the free market principles to the hard cases, because if you can prove it in the hard cases, and there's nothing much harder than roads, then you can prove it in all these other cases more easily. Whereas if you stick to the easy cases, then people wonder, well, yeah, you can privatize the post office, you know, and maybe public housing, you can privatize that, but, you know, for roads. And also, roads are a stickler, because a lot of times you're trying to convert people to the one true faith, you know, freedom, and they say, well, what about the roads? You know, how can we have roads without the government? So I think it's good to focus on that. Another one is, let's take the offense, not the defense. Let's put the ball in their park. Nobody's talking about private roads. Let's talk about private roads and let them react to that instead of them telling us, oh, we're selfish or callous because we don't have more welfare or something like that. Another one is MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. These poor people, are in a worse position compared to, say, Ducks Unlimited or Nature Conservancy or Western Wilderness, because all these environmental groups, they can go out and buy, 10 square miles of land and then run it the way they want to run it. They can have a demonstration project, whereas MAD can't. So I feel for MAD. I think that their analysis is wrong, but their hearts are in the right place. They want to stop fatalities on highways, which seems to be a reasonable thing. Okay, so these are my reasons for roads, and I have several articles calling people who disagree with me road socialists. I was once in a debate with Milton Friedman, and I called him a road socialist, and he didn't really much like that. I can't understand why, because he is a road... if it walks like a duck and quacks like a road socialist, well, then, maybe it is a road socialist, and, he favors government roads, so why isn't that road socialism? You're not supposed to say it in polite society? I don't know. Most economists are road socialists, that's sort of a historical way to put it or a radical way to put it. But one of the reasons I do that, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, you're in danger of being dismissed. It's so out of it here, I mentioned roads privatization and nobody's saying, you're crazy here because this is a different kind of a milieu. But if you go out into the real world, Mises Institute isn't the real world in some ways. People say, what are you, crazy? And they ignore you. So I don't like to be ignored, so I use road socialism as a way to, it's hard to ignore that because it sounds weird. People say it's crazy and weird because the government has always run roads. But that's not true. My research into history shows that early in the 9th century of England, they had private roads. And in the early part of this country, in the 18th century, they had private roads. They would call them turnpike roads. Somebody would make a road. They didn't have tar. They didn't have concrete in those days, but they had dirt roads. And every couple of miles, there'd be a toll booth, and they would charge you a fee for going along the road. And the fees were interesting because they would charge you more for a wagon than a horse, more for a wagon with two axles than one axle. They would even charge you based on the width of the wheel. If the wheel was wide, they would charge you less because you're damping down the road, keeping it flat. Whereas the wheel was narrow, think of an ice skate. What you do is you put a rut in the road, so they would charge you more. So it was sort of rational, namely, the market was sort of working. They were trying to encourage you to have the sort of a wagon that would help the road, and they would make it cheaper that way. Which, when I get to congestion pricing later, I'll show you that the government does the exact opposite. But I'll get to that in a minute. Some economists say, well, the road is a public good. You can't exclude non-users. Well, the government can't exclude non-users. Doesn't mean the market can. And the other one is that it's non-rivalrous. If there's an empty road, why shouldn't someone use it? But if you go on that public good argument about the non-rivalrousness, then any non-full hotel or non-full theater or non-full anything is not rivalrous for the last few seats. For example, in this room here, there are maybe 10 or 15 empty seats. So that means the marginal cost of that is zero, filling in one more seat, and therefore we shouldn't charge because of marginal cost pricing. This is what the mainstream economics thinks. And that means that unless everything is always at 100% capacity, and nothing ever is, then we can't privatize anything. So we have a reductio ad absurdum in that regard. So much for mainstream economists. An interesting thing is, what is the job of economists under road socialism? And economists have more jobs with government than not. One of the things about the Fed, one of the reasons why the economists support the Fed so much is the Fed stuffs money down economists' throats with all sorts of subsidies and stuff, so it's no wonder. Well, it's similar here. There's this thing called the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that hires a lot of statisticians and economists, and maybe private road owners wouldn't, so the bread is buttered on one side, so we're not going to get a fair hearing among people who stand to lose financially from privatization. Okay, another reason I have two main reasons for getting into this road thing. One is road deaths. In the last 10 years, about 40,000 people a year die on the roads. Now, 40,000 people, put that in some sort of context. I mean, how many people died in 9/11? Just 3,000? How many people died from FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers in the aftermath of Katrina? Just 1,900. Now, look, I'm not trying to deprecate 1,900 deaths in New Orleans or 3,000 deaths in New York City, but trying to put this in context, 40,000 people a year die. That's more than many diseases. That's more than anything. I mean, how many people get shot, like the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman thing? Just one person got shot, and everybody's all excited about that, which they should be, because every life is precious. And every time a little girl gets lost, everyone goes looks for her. That's good. But a lot of little girls and a lot of people get killed in that 40,000, and that's despicable. I mean, that's monstrous. That's horrible that 40,000 people die. And nobody says squat about it. You know, they think it's inevitable, sort of like death and taxes, but it's not inevitable. And I think if we privatize roads, we'll see that it's not. Another reason, sort of a personal reason, traffic congestion. We have cars that are capable of going 75, 80 miles an hour safely. And in cities, you know, 30 or 40 miles an hour. And yet they creep and crawl along due to traffic congestion. It's a pain in the neck. And then you get road rage because, oh, he cut me off. I'm going to go shoot him. And you get deaths that way. So there's a lot of reasons to be involved in road privatization. Okay, now the argument will be, we shouldn't privatize roads because privatizing roads has got nothing to do with who owns and manages them. Rather, it's due to things like speed, alcohol, weather conditions, things like that. Those are the causes of the death. So what are you, drunk or something on these cough drops you're using to think that it's the government's fault? It's not the government's fault. It's speed, alcohol, weather conditions. Now, there's this guy, Sam Peltzman at Chicago, another road socialist at the University of Chicago. There are a bunch of pinkos there. And what he does is he lists how many causes of death. Remember, my contention is that the cause of death is the government managing the roads, owning the roads and managing them. But he's got his analysis, and I'll read them. There are about 25 here. Vehicle speed, alcohol consumption, the number of young drivers, because young drivers are less safe. Changes in drivers' incomes. Changes in drivers' incomes. You can see an econometric equation going on here. The money costs of accidents, the average age of cars, the ratio of new cars to all cars, because it's been suggested that while drivers familiarize themselves with their new cars, accident risk may increase. Traffic density, expenditures on traffic law enforcement by state highway patrols, expenditures on roads, the ratio of imports to total cars, because evidence that small cars, this is sort of dated, in those days the foreign cars were the small ones, are more lethal. Education of the population, availability of hospital care. The National Highway Safety Traffic Administration has 108 different causes. I'm not going to read all them, it'll take me the whole hour. Things like, you know, how do you have helicopter ambulances? Because if you have helicopter ambulances, you have fewer deaths. Notice how nitpicky they're getting. These are not really the causes. This is a confusion of ultimate causes with proximate causes. Look, suppose I take a rifle and I shoot right through that window and I hit some passerby. And you all grab me and accuse me of murder. And I say, tut, 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 I'm not a murderer. The bullet killed him. The bullet killed him. I'm innocent. I'm, you know, it's 100 yards away. I'm totally innocent. Well, if I said that, I would be guilty of confusing an ultimate cause with a proximate cause. Yes, the proximate cause was the bullet, but I'm the ultimate cause. Yes, the proximate cause is speed, alcohol, weather conditions, yak, 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 but the ultimate cause is the manager. Look, we all went the other day to that pizza place, remember? We had dinner there. And let's suppose that the pizza restaurant goes broke. And now we're brought in as market analysts to figure out why they went broke. And we start saying, well, location, 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 location. It's not located in a good area. The cook doesn't know how to make a good pizza. The place was filthy. They didn't hire somebody. The service was lousy. And we start making lists like this. These are all proximate causes. The ultimate cause of the failure of that restaurant, if it fails, or if it succeeds, is the manager. The manager didn't pick a good location. The manager didn't give someone a broom and say, go sweep the place. The manager didn't hire a good cook. So the key is the manager. It's not these proximate causes. It's the ultimate cause. And the ultimate. So don't be fooled by these long lists of causes of deaths and accidents. Those are just proximate causes. At this point, when I lecture to hostile audiences, I start reading John Stuart Mill because they're already booing me. And I start saying, you know, you got to hear both sides, yak, yak, yak. But I'll skip that. I don't think I have to prevail upon you to, you know, give me a fair hearing on that. Okay, so how would it work? How would private highways work? Well, just like anything else, individuals would own them. And they would manage them, and they would charge money for them, and they would make a profit or a loss. And if they did a good job, they would buy another highway. And if they did a bad job, they'd go broke, and other people would take over the highway. It'd be the same thing, just like the highways in the 18th century, just like trains. In New York City, there was the BMT, the IRT, and the IND. The BMT and the IRT were private railways, or private underground railways that were created by private enterprise. And they charged a fee, and they were going to raise their rate from a nickel to a dime. And the mayor of New York City, sort of a pre-Bloomberg type, said, oh, this is unconscionable. We have to nationalize them or municipalize them. And now everyone thinks that transit has to be public, but it doesn't have to be. It started out private. Now, a lot of people are very unaccustomed to this, so I'll accustom you to it. Private roads. Private roads. Private roads. Are you now accustomed to it? There's nothing unique about long, thin things like roads, such that long, thin things can't be private. Now, what are other long, thin things? I don't know why that's so funny. I never got laughs on this one, but who knows? Maybe it's a personal thing. I don't know. What are the other long, thin things? Water pipes, sewer pipes, electric lines. In the old days, telephone wires. Nowadays, we have new technology. Garbage collection. It's not a long, thin thing, but it makes a long, thin route. Post office. The reason I want to include telephone lines is because I'm of the opinion that we have to demonstrate not only is free enterprise viable nowadays under present technology, but it always was throughout all of history. The market always works, not just thanks to some technology. Now we have cell phones. We don't need telephone wires. You see, what people think of is they think of houses already built. And now it would be a horrible big challenge to figure out, say, a sewer pipe, because everyone would have to agree. Think of a square mile and a couple of thousand houses, and they have no sewer pipes, and the cost, the transactions cost of all of them agreeing on one sewer company is very, very high. So they think this is something that the government has to do, but it's a matter of time. There used to be a rock and roll song, Ticka, 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 Good Timing, or something like that. 50s rock, it sort of dates me a little bit, as if you didn't know already. But the idea is, if you look at it from the point of view when the house is already built, then it's hard. But if you look at it from the point of view of you own the square mile and you're going to put in 1,000 houses, are you going to put in the sewer lines before you even start building the houses? Yes. Because then you can sell the houses for a lot more, because people then can move in and have sewer lines and water lines, electric, garbage, whatever. You can make a deal with one garbage company and sort of a condominium kind of thing that if they don't do a good job, then by a majority vote, they can get rid of them. So the idea, whether it's railroads or highways or any of these things, long, thin things are not anything, are not an exception to the general rule that we can have private enterprise. Okay, so it would work like any other business. You want to build a new road, you got to assemble some land, you got to attract investors, hire a labor force, build for it, charge for it, set up rules of the road, fill in the potholes, put up traffic signs, whatever, and you run the highway or the street or whatever it is. Now, a lot of people say, well, how would they do this? How would they do that? And Murray Rothbard says, if shoes were previously run by the government and only government could make shoes, and some maniac like me was saying, well, we should privatize shoe manufacturer and private people could make shoes, immediately all sorts of questions would come up. Well, how many shoe stores would be on each block? Would they be brown shoes or black shoes or red ones? How about laces versus loafers? How about sneakers? How about thongs? How about this? It's impossible to anticipate fully what the market would do. It's an entrepreneurial thing. It's not an economic analysis kind of a thing. So I say the same thing with roads. It's hard, it's difficult, it's impossible to say how a private road system would work. All we can do is speculate. But we can speculate based on extrapolation from other things that are similar, like, say, railroads or what have you, or just using common sense. So we have to speculate about this, and let me speculate about this. Let's talk a little bit about safety. Right now, the minimum speed in the highway, I think I came here on Highway 85. Many of us came on Highway 85. The minimum speed when you have a three-lane highway is a minimum of 40 and a maximum of 70. A lot of people do 75. They don't give you a ticket for that. So the variance in speed is pretty high. Not too many people doing 40, but there's a big variance. Maybe the problem is not speed. Maybe the problem is the variance in speed. Maybe some highway should say, okay, the minimum speed is 55 and the maximum speed is 70. And maybe that would reduce accidents. Will it? I don't know. I'm not an expert in any of this stuff. I'm just a dumb economist. But I'm saying that right now the rules of the road come from one place, Washington, D.C. mainly. And we don't have any experiments. We can't say, well, on your road, you're doing the 40 through 75, and on my road, everyone has to do at least 55, and no one can do more than 70, and I strictly enforce that. And then we'll see if there are fewer accidents on my road than on your road, and if so, then maybe people will adopt my way of doing things. It's sort of like computers or televisions or shoes or anything else. People try different things and some work, some don't work. And that's why we get better shoes and better TVs. Imagine if the government said, well, here's the way to make a TV. And that's it. And nobody could change it unless you have a congressional vote or something. Maybe the best way to do it is to have an 85-mile speed limit there. Everybody has to do 85 there, everybody has to do 70 there, and maybe everyone has to do 55 there. Maybe. I don't know. It's possible. But if some road tried that and had much better safety, then other roads would try it, and it would percolate throughout the society, and we'd have fewer deaths. Or maybe it should be 80, 70, and 60. I don't know. I'm no expert on that. Maybe what they ought to do is be very strict on that left lane. Sometimes you get a car in the left lane, and the car is doing 65. Is that legal? Yes. But everyone wants to do 75, so you have to sort of go around and through, and maybe that causes more accidents. Another thing that ticks me off is when you have a two-lane highway, and you have two trucks, one following the other, and you know that this truck is going to try to pass that truck, and you know it's going to take them 15 minutes to do it, because they're going to have a race. And what you do, you're over here, what you do is you go up to 90 miles an hour to get ahead of those guys so that you can, you know, put them behind you. And that's very dangerous. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe what we ought to do is have a rule that if you have two trucks racing for 15 miles, 15 minutes or whatever, that the truck on the right that didn't give way has to pay a big fine. They don't have that now. So these are speculations. I don't know that it's true. I'm just sort of using my common sense. I'm thinking, if I ran a road, how would it be more safe? Yak, yak, yak. But the essence that I want you to take away from this is not so much that my way or the highway, that this is the way. Rather, that if different people could try different things. I mean, look, just shirts. I'm looking at people wearing shirts. You've all got different shirts. Different entrepreneurs try different shirts. Should the stripes be this way? Should there be polka dots? Should there be whatever? And they'll try, say, stripes this way, and nobody buys it. Well, then we know that's not good. Okay, what are the other ways that we could experiment? Well, you know what an accordionized car is? That's a smushed car. You know, the car is maybe 15 feet long, but when it's in an accident, it's about 5 feet long. Maybe take that sucker, put it up on a pedestal in a dangerous area, and sort of hint as to what can happen to you if you're driving too fast or driving not well or what have you. Another one is chicken races. You know, people have chicken races, and you know what a chicken race is. You know, there are two cars, one going this way and one going this way, and the one who veers away from the other first is the chicken. No, you people aren't into chicken races? What's the matter with you? Maybe between 3 and 5 in the morning, if you have a road like this, let's say here's a three-lane highway, and here's this one goes this way, and this one goes that way. Maybe what you do is you just have traffic going here and here, and over here you have a chicken race. From 3 to 5 in the morning, you sell tickets, and this will get rid of, and this will get rid of a lot of drivers who shouldn't be on the road in the first place. But it's voluntary, so, you know, I'm just speculating as to ways people can make money on highways and promote safety. What else? Well, these cemeteries, you know, they have these, sometimes it's an accident, they'll have a cross or a Jewish star or something, have big, big crosses where there are lots of accidents, and every time there's an accident, have another big cross there. So if you go around a turn and you can see 25 crosses or Jewish stars or indications of cemeteries, maybe that'll make you drive more carefully. Again, I don't know. I'm just speculating. I'm throwing out a whole bunch of possibilities as to how we can promote safety. But the idea is not so much that any one of them is right or wrong. The idea is that people should experiment. I mean, if the rules of the road come from Washington, D.C., as if on graven, what is it, on cement tablet? Not cement tablets. You know, like Moses bringing down the law. That's not the way to run a railroad. That's not the way to run a highway. What about those cat's eyes? You know, they have cat's eyes, sort of reflectors, and then on the left they'll have yellow line, and on the right they have white. This is an attempt to promote safety. You're all familiar with that? They've done experiments, and they find that the more safety that people have, the faster they'll go. In other words, if the road isn't that clearly marked, they'll go slower. And if the road is beautifully marked, then they'll just go faster at night. So there seems to be some sort of level of safety that people want. I mean, I know a way to make sure that we have zero road deaths. Make a maximum speed limit of 10 miles an hour. Okay, 15 miles an hour. Of course, if cars went at 15 miles an hour, a lot of people would die because they couldn't get refrigerated food in hospitals and, you know, stuff like that. Another way is to put a sword of Damocles in the steering wheel. You know what a sword of Damocles is? The king Damocles was sitting there and there was a sword over his head. Well, just put a little sword in the driver's wheel, and any time the car bumps, even slightly, you get killed. Well, that'll shake you up a little. Now, I'm not seriously contemplating, you know, a road compelling car drivers to have that, otherwise it can't get on the road. But I'm just saying that there seems to be a desire on all of us, or on the average person, or on the part of many people, to have a certain amount of safety. And if there's more safety in the road, then they just go faster. And if there's less, they go slower. And this is a problem that road managers, entrepreneurs of roads, have to deal with. We economists don't have to deal with. We just have to note that this is a complication that has to be overcome by a free enterprise industry. Okay, what else is going on? Okay, so let's suppose we have private roads. How many deaths do you think we'll have? And I speculate in one of the chapters in my book on this. Right now there are 40,000. And what I do is I start comparing public and private, like sanitation. What are the costs of removing a ton of sanitation privately and publicly? Oh, it's 3 to 1. There have been research. This is an empirical research. This is not praxeology. This is economic history. Austrians do both. We're not limited to praxeology. We do this. So what I do is I extrapolate. I say, well, if they're 3 times more efficient in sanitation or what's the difference between FedEx and the post office in terms of efficiency? It's 4 to 1, whatever it is. If we apply that to roads, then instead of 40,000, maybe there'll be 10,000 deaths if it's 4 to 1 efficiency. I mean, that's all we can do, or that's all I could think to do. Maybe you people will think of another way to estimate the reduction in the deaths under private enterprise. But my thought is, if we go from public to private in roads, and we go from 40,000 to X in deaths, the analogy would be if we go from public to private in any other thing where you have some sort of comparison, and the private is 2, 3, 4, 5 times more efficient. Well, if they were 2, 3, 4, 5 times more efficient here, then the deaths would be reduced accordingly. Now, there's this guy, Larry White, who is sort of an Austrian free market libertarian who criticized me on this. And he said that let's suppose we go from 40,000 deaths to 10,000 deaths. So what he's saying is that the government is not really responsible for 40,000 deaths. It's only responsible for 30,000 deaths. So I'm not calculating correctly, because if under the market there would be 10,000 deaths anyway, then the government is only adding 30. So it's only responsible for 30. It's not responsible for 40. My criticism of him, or my defense of my original calculation, is as follows. Let's stipulate that Hitler killed exactly 6 million Jews. But it took him 4 years to do it. And in 4 years, there would have been natural death of some of those Jews. Let's say 100,000 of them would have died, just to pick a round number. So Hitler is only responsible for 5.9 million deaths? No, he's responsible for 6 million. He killed 6 million. Just because 100,000 would have died anyway, doesn't matter. He's still responsible for 6 million. That's my attempt to respond to Larry White. And say that the government is responsible for all 40,000, not just for the additional 30,000. Most important, as I end this section of my talk, is the benefits of competition come about in ways we can't anticipate. Who would have anticipated the benefits in computers? I mean, Kodak was photography. They didn't anticipate this. Remington Rand was typewriters. They didn't anticipate that they would be broke soon. So we can anticipate the benefits of the free enterprise system, but we have good and sufficient reason to believe that there would be plenty of them based on our experience with many other things. Okay, now what I'm going to do is talk about objections. There are many, many objections. The first objection is, well, you're going to have to stop every few feet and toss a coin in some person's place. Because suppose here's a road, and here's a house, and here's a house, and there's a house, and there's a house, and there are lots of houses all over the place. And as you go by, what you're going to have to, every house is going to have a little coin box, and you're going to have to put a coin in everyone's thing, and traffic will grind to a standstill. That's one objection. When I first started writing this stuff, it was in the 70s. This is before they had these universal product code things. You know, right now you go through the grocery store and they slide the thing over the light and it goes blip and it registers. Well, in those days they didn't have it, or it was just coming in. So I was reading all sorts of grocery journals and pharmacy journals, and people were saying, you know, why are you reading grocery journals? The reason I was reading grocery journals is that my idea was to take those universal product codes that are on every can of soda and every pack of whatever, cigarettes or lima beans, and put them on the underbody of cars. And then as you go over this grid, and maybe this grid, it registers as to where you went, and then at the end of the month you get a bill, or you pay money in advance, and the computer just sort of deducts it. So the idea that you would have to pay a penny or 1/10 of a penny every time you pass the house, and you'd have to go at 2 miles an hour to do this on average, that's a fallacy. Now, of course, this brings up the problem of privacy. Because if somebody knows where you were, you can't go visit your proctologist or your mistress, and you know everyone's gonna, your wife is gonna know where you've been, and you know that's no good. So, well, you people are, most of you aren't married yet, but you know later on you'll come up with these challenges. Well, you know, privacy is a very important issue, and my understanding is that those road owners that want, those customers that want privacy will be willing to pay more for it because it's not a right, it's a valuable commodity, privacy. Look, if privacy were a right, right now I'm invading all your privacy by looking at you, and you're invading my privacy by looking at me. And if I've got binoculars and I can see some lady half undressed because she didn't close her curtain or something, I'm invading her privacy. That's wrong. Privacy is a positive right. But be that as it may, the market can give us goods and services we want. And if we want privacy, they'll figure out a way to do it. They will guarantee that in the free society, there'll be no government snooping. Government shouldn't be invading privacy, but government shouldn't be doing anything anyway, so that issue doesn't come up. Okay, the next objection is, where are my notes here? How could you get a road? How could you create a road? Let's suppose we want to have a road from, where are we? We're in, near Atlanta. We're near Atlanta, and we want to have a road to San Francisco. And there's the road we want. As the crow flies, you know, that's the shortest distance. We want to have a road. Well, how many people own land between Atlanta and San Francisco? I don't know, 100,000, give or take, say. So we'd have to go to each of them and say, okay, Farmer Jones, we want to buy your land, and Farmer Smith, we want to buy your land, and Farmer Green, we want to buy your land. And this would be problematic because of the holdout problem. Somebody, I usually think of Cartman of South Park, is going to say, screw you guys, screw you guys, screw you guys, we're not selling. So how could we have private roads without eminent domain, or in Canada it's called expropriation? I mean, that's the way they build roads now. They just say, okay, we're building a road here like this, and all you guys that own land there, we're going to take over and we'll pay you what we think is fair market value, and that's the way roads are assembled. But without the government, you couldn't do this. So how could we do it? Well, there are various ways. One, you don't have to build the road here on A. You could build it B. You could build it C. You could build it D. You could build it E. And you could buy options to buy land. You know what an option to buy land is? An option is you go to Farmer Jones over here and you say, look, Farmer Jones, we'd like to buy your land, but we're not sure. And the market price is $10,000 an acre. We'll pay you $15,000 an acre, but we're still not sure we want to buy it. So what we'd like to do is to buy an option to buy the land at the agreed upon price of $15,000. Per acre, and we'll pay you just a couple of $100 for that option, and we'll either exercise that option or not within a year. So in other words, we're tying you up to an agreed upon price. And you go around all of these, and this might be 15 or 20 miles from D to E, and any of these routes would suffice. And as soon as you line up an option for all the land, then you go that way. Or you could go to the people and say, hey, you guys, we want to buy land and we'll pay 50% more for the land, but we're not sure if we're going on A, B, C, D, E route. And you guys all work together and try to overcome the problem of collective action or these costs of getting together. But suppose Cartman owns this land. You get it? He owns... Not very wide, just say a mile wide, but 15 or 20 miles north and south. And we can't get around him. It's the old homestead, or he just doesn't like us or whatever. And now what happened is I got into a big debate with Gordon Tullock, who is a famous, public choice guy. And what I and my co-author, my son Matthew, said, you know, it's interesting, my son Matthew and I were discussing this from his age 15 to his age 17. we discussed practically nothing else. There were a few other things, clean your room, drink your milk, but we discussed nothing but this, and then I wrote the article. And then I, you know, what should I do? Should I, you know, just thank him? I mean, it was really a contribution of the two of us, and I made him a co-author, even though he didn't write anything. And he kept saying, but no one will believe it. And I said, but is it true? He said, oh, yeah, of course it's true. And I said, well, we don't care if people believe it. It's the truth, and it was a combined effort. And what we said is you could tunnel under Cartman or build over Cartman, build a bridge over him, and this would not violate property rights. Now, the alternative to that, the supposed refutation of that is this thing called the ad coelum doctrine. And what the ad coelum doctrine is a thing that says that if you own a square mile of land, then you own down into the earth's core and then up into the heavens. Ad coelum doctrine. You've heard of that. But the ad coelum doctrine is not compatible with libertarianism. Libertarianism is based on homesteading. That's the way you get ownership of land, based on homesteading. And this would play havoc with airplane travel, because the airplane at 30,000 feet would have to pay a fee to every square mile he passes over. By the way, this also, the libertarian view would be based on homesteading. So you would allow slant drilling. So if you had two pieces of land, A and B, and there was oil under A, B could still drill under A's territory. Namely, slant drilling would be allowed. And there are lots of debates over this in oil and minerals, mineral rights. But I think the correct libertarian view is that since A didn't homestead stuff a mile down, B would be the first one under his territory. How close under A can he go? Well, this depends upon how strong the land is. If the land is like in New Orleans and it's sort of swampish, and you build, you tunnel under someone else's land, you cave their buildings in, you can't do that because you're invading them, you're trespassing on their rights. But on the other hand, if it's like Manhattan Island, which is just a solid rock, you can tunnel under them pretty closely. So the way out of the Cartman challenge is you can tunnel under Cartman or build over him, a bridge over him. Now, of course, if you build a bridge over him, you're going to stop his sunlight, so you have to make it translucent, and you're going to stop his rain, so you have to make those grids. And in this article, the debate that I had with Gordon Tullock, we went into all sorts of things like that. So the bottom line is, you don't need eminent domain. You can have private road collection of land. Okay, the next one is this thing called the blockade. What's the blockade? Here it sort of looks like a tic-tac-toe thing. These are all roads, and you have a house right here. That's your house. And you try to get out of your house or into your house, and this road owner says, well, sorry, I'm not letting you out into there. It's called the blockade. Well, you know, right now when you buy a house, there's a thing called title insurance. You get title insurance to make sure that the house you bought really is owned by the previous owner and some other guy doesn't come up later and say, hey, that's my house, get out. Well, in addition to title insurance, you would have a thing called access insurance. Namely, before you bought a house, you would make sure that you could get in and out without paying an arm and a leg or without being blockaded and you have to learn how to pole vault or to get a helicopter or something like that. And would the road owner have an incentive to be reasonable? Of course he would, because he wants you to buy a house. He wants you to set up factories. He wants you to set up houses and shopping malls and stuff like that. And if he won't obligate himself contractually to not pull a quick one or a fast one on you by blockading you or charging an arm and a leg for ingress or egress, well, you're not going to build there. And then he'll have an empty road with nobody on it and nobody using it, and that's no way to run a business. So that objection, I think, goes by the board. Who determines the rules of the road? That's another objection. You know, Sweden went from, I think it was riding on the left side of the road to riding on the right side of the road, and it took them a whole year to do it. You know, they would announce, well, in 1 year we're going to do it, then in 11 months we're going to do it, and they get all sorts of movie stars saying, well, I'm cool with this, and I'm going to get used to riding on. It's a big deal. Now, in other words, what I'm saying is that the rules of the road can't be too different, otherwise there'll be smack-ups. Like, suppose on my road, I said you have to drive on the left, like the British or the Australians. Not going to work. People aren't used to it. You can't go from riding on the right side and then you get onto my road and you start riding on the left side. So there's a limitation as to how different the rules of the roads can be. Okay, some roads can have 40 minimum and 70 maximum. Some can have 85, 75, and 65. That's reasonable. But there's a limit to how different the rules of the road can be. And we have instances there also. I mean, you go to one bowling alley, it's the same as another bowling alley. You can't make the rules very different, otherwise people won't come there. Okay, the next objection. Now I get into, congestion. What's going on with congestion? What's going on with traffic congestion and why we have traffic congestion? Here is my slide on congestion. And what I do is I have, here's the time of day, 5 in the morning, 9 in the morning, 5 in the afternoon, 7 at night. And from 07 to 8:30, there's a high use of the highway. And from 5 to 7, the evening rush hour. You get this? This is quantity of cars. It's not a supply and demand, it's time over here and quantity of use of the road. Now, what you have is a thing called peak load pricing. Peak load pricing. And what's peak load pricing? Peak load pricing is when demand is high, you charge more. When demand is low, you charge less. For example, the ski lodge. During the winter, the ski lodge charges an arm and a leg to go and live in their motel. During the summer, they still charge, but much less because people don't really want to go to the ski lodge during the summer. Although it's nice, you walk around, you can go on the chairlifts. Similarly, I used to teach at Holy Cross in Massachusetts, and the big season was November when the trees were turning. It's beautiful. The trees are all orange and red, and a lot of tourists come, and you want to have a convention there. Don't do it in November or October because the prices are double. Whereas in other periods of time, it's much less. Similarly with Florida. In Florida, during the winter, the prices of hotels are much more, and in the summer, the prices of the hotels are less. Now, the way the market works is it engages in peak load pricing. It's sort of as if an attempt to iron out the oscillations, because if you charge a high price during the peaks, you lower the quantity. Yes? Right? And if you charge a low price during the troughs, you raise the quantity, and all is well. So instead of getting these gigantic oscillations, you get smaller oscillations, and ideally you get no oscillations. What does the government do? The government engages in anti-peak load pricing. Namely, it does the exact opposite of what it should be doing. How does this work? The way it works is if you buy a monthly ticket to get across the bridge, it's much cheaper per trip, right? I mean, you know, you buy a thing, you can go the whole month, and let's say it's a dollar a trip. Whereas if you were to just go on a one-shot basis, it might be $3 or $4 for the trip. So it's much cheaper to go if you're a commuter. Well, when do commuters commute? During rush hours. So what they're doing is exacerbating the peaks and the troughs. They are worsening traffic congestion. They are charging less during the rush hours, thus encouraging people, and then they charge more during the troughs, thus discouraging people. And then they have the audacity to give us all these nanny things, you know, like carpool and asking businessmen to change their... not everybody should go 9 to 5. Somebody should go 8 to 6. Someone 7 to 4. Other people 10 to 6 or 7, whatever. Bus lanes, high occupancy vehicle lanes, things like that. I was once in California on an HOV, and I was with a passenger, so I was zipping along at 50 miles an hour, and everyone was bumper to bumper. And then I try to get off, and they wouldn't let me get off. Because they were so ticked off at me because I was going fast, so I couldn't get off that lane, and that slowed the lane. It was just a mess. probably what a private entrepreneur would do would be to sell a ticket to guys in limousines who want to go fast and charge them triple the price. And now they could go and make very strict rules about letting them get off at the exits. So here's a case where the government is just doing things all wrong. And nor do we need high technology. Here is another way that it could be done. Here's the city center. You charge more in the city center and less as you get out. And you give people a different color code so that the cops can see who's there. Private cops, hopefully. And so even at a low-tech way, you can deal with the peak load pricing problem. Okay, the next objection that I have, why pay anything? Highways are free now. This is silly because they shouldn't really be called freeways. They should be called taxways because we pay for it anyway. And we pay for it a lot more through taxes because government is inefficient. So that objection is silly. Which road would get what green light time? Well, it depends upon negotiation, or it depends upon how you privatize. Well, how should we privatize? The Mises Institute is on Magnolia Street or Magnolia Avenue. Who should own Magnolia Avenue? Ideally, if we had a God's eye view, we would know whose taxes went into making it, and we'd make shares in the road based upon that. In other words, Lou Rockwell wouldn't own just this little patch right in front of Magnolia and be able to charge. That would be silly. I went over that objection. Rather, the Mises Institute would own one share out of 10,000 shares. So say there are 10,000 people that own Magnolia Avenue. And they would make the rules of the road, and they would deal with the other roads. But we don't have a God's eye view. And how then could we do it? Well, one way is to make shares of the road based on the people who have houses on the side of the road, because we can infer that they are the ones that use the road. Another is if there was a trucking company that used the road, maybe they'd get more shares because they used it more. Namely, you know, we're against the labor theory of value, but we're not against the labor theory of property. Because the labor theory of property is Lockean homesteading. So people who use the roads get to own the roads. Okay, I'm pretty much out of objections now, and let me just talk a little bit about privatizing bodies of water. But to just conclude, there's nothing crazy about privatizing roads, and I think it'll save lives and reduce traffic congestion and make our lives all better and longer. Okay, what's going on with water privatization? I haven't really done much on that. I've written maybe 4 or 5 articles on it, but it's a much more difficult problem to face because water is connected. You know, the Mississippi leads into the Gulf of Mexico, so should the proper ownership be the Mississippi River or the Gulf of Mexico or both together? And if both together, then maybe all the water on the whole planet, one guy owns it, which is a problem. The reason I face this issue, or the reason it came up to me, is one, I want to privatize the most difficult cases, not the easiest cases, and water, oceans, lakes, rivers, things like that. Another is I was in the aftermath of Katrina in New Orleans, and the river poured down on us. I mean, New Orleans is sort of shaped like a bowl under the sea level, and you know, the Mississippi River is higher than the land. You go by the levees and, you know, the boats are way above the houses when the boats go on the Mississippi. Another reason is, my understanding is that the earth, the surface of the earth is about 25% land and about 75% water. And my estimation, it's very hard for me to get data on this. I'm into data. It's difficult to get data on what the world GDP is on land versus the world GDP on water. My expectation is that the GDP on land is about 99% and on water 1%. And I'm not sure, it could be 98 and 2, but my understanding is that there's a disproportionate amount of GDP on land than water. Now, part of it might be that there are more people on the land. Okay, fair enough. You have to adjust for that. But I still think that the tragedy of the commons lowers the value of the water to the human race. And values are very important, because if we want to cure cancer and we want to get to Mars and we want to do all sorts of great things, we need more wealth. I mean, it sounds callous. You know, we just got, what is it, cash registers for hearts and dollar signs on our eyeballs. We're just talking about money, money, money. But the money, money, money means that we can live longer lives, happier lives, and cure diseases and go to Mars or to the next planet or whatever. So it's important that we rest, W-R-E-S-T, rest as much as we can out of the natural resources we're given. And the water isn't giving its fair share to the human race. And we got to get more out of it. And how can we get more out of it? Privatize it. Because if we privatize it, we don't have the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons means, you know, that we overfish. Because why should I leave some fish for you? Why not grab all I can? Whereas if I own them, then I wouldn't grab it all because I need some fish tomorrow. Okay, so what are some of the problems of the oceans? One problem is that all the water leads into every other bit of water. Another problem is you have vertical swaps of water, namely the water, evaporates into the clouds and it rains down on us. As in the last few days in Alabama here, we've been inundated by rain. So there's a cycle or a circle of water up and down, and then there's a cycle or a circle of water, the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico into the Atlantic Ocean. So then the question comes, well, Nozick, another supposed free enterpriser, said, well, if you drop a can of tomato soup into the ocean, do you own the whole ocean or do you just lost your tomato soup? And this is his attempt to show the foolishness of privatizing. Well, there is some sense to this, because you can only privatize goods, and goods are known as scarce. They have to be scarce. Otherwise, they're just factors of production. And right now, the Mississippi is probably scarce because there's enough traffic on those boats, but there are parts of the Atlantic and the Pacific that are just totally empty, and it might be premature to think of privatization there, just as it is now premature to think of privatization on the moon or on Mars. But we can think about these things, even though they're not yet ready to be privatized, because you can't privatize until it's scarce, and some of these things aren't scarce. So these are some of the problems that those of you who I can entice to work with me on this and write about this and think about this and do research on this and think about this as a possible research project. Although, if you're going for a PhD, don't do it. My advice is, if you're going for a PhD, do something, whatever your dissertation advisor is interested in, do that. You know, just get the PhD. Don't do something where you work on it for 2 years and then you got a bunch of water socialists who say, well, this can't pass, and you don't get your PhD. The idea of a dissertation is to get the PhD, not to do weird and wonderful things. Do that afterward. Okay, I've sort of run out of steam. I'm talking about privatization. I've got a few more minutes, so I'll take a few questions. Yes, sir. Privatizing the sky. Well, I can interpret privatizing the sky in two ways. The oxygen in the sky, or the minerals, or whatever is up there, and then the space. And the oxygen is not a scarce good. We have oxygen tents and we have oxygen tanks, and when we go to the moon, oxygen will be a scarce good and you'll have to buy and sell it. There was this book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, by Heinlein, and oxygen was like milk or orange juice or anything else. You had to buy it and sell it, and that's fine. But here, happily right now, we don't have a shortage, oxygen is not a scarce good, so we can't privatize it yet. Who knows if one day we'll run out of it. Now, with regard to the space, you know the way the airplanes do it? You know, if you're going east, you go at, 10, 12, 15,000 feet above, and if you're going west, you go at a different level so that the planes don't hit each other. We are coming to the time where, pathways in the air are becoming scarce and might even be scarce now. Which means, who should own them? Well, I think the private air companies that have been using them based on Lockheed and Rothbardy and Hoppe and homesteading theory. So yes, we should privatize that, and soon not any private air person is going to be able to just go up and fly around, because it'd be owned by other people. So yes, we have to think in terms of privatization there too. Yes, ma'am. Okay, that's a very good objection. I was implicitly, I don't think I said it explicitly, but I was sort of hinting that the only desiderata on the part of consumers was safety. And it's obviously not true because people want much more. Although I did say we could have full safety if we had a speed limit of 15 miles an hour or 10 miles an hour. And obviously people don't want that. Look, whenever we buy a shirt, we want a lot of things from the shirt. We want coverage. We want, coolness or whatever it is that we want from shirts. We want many things from anything we buy, and roads are no exception. So I think, again, I'm no marketing expert, but I think people want safety and they want speed and they want convenience. So what the road owner would try to do is to maximize the package or the package of qualities. He would want to get now some people would look, it's sort of like smoking. In some people want to be able to smoke. And some restaurants, if we didn't have smoking laws, they would just allow smoking anywhere. Other people, the health food types or the healthy types, don't want any smoking at all. And then third parties want smoking sections, or maybe at night you have smoking and the day you don't. And the market would try to adjust to what people wanted. So they might say, okay, in the left lane, you can go 90 miles an hour. And you get speed there, but and if you want safety, you go on the middle lane or the right lane. But you're quite right to make that point, and I should have made it more clear that people want much more than just safety. They want safety plus speed plus convenience plus this plus that. And the take Disney World. What do people want when they go to Disney World? They want safety. They don't want to die on those rides, but on the other hand, they want some sort of thrill. And then they want stores there, and they want a lot of things. So it would be no different on the roads. One last question. Yes, sir, in the back. Well, I think that it would be almost silly to try to privatize the middle of, the ocean near Antarctica. Nobody would do it because it doesn't pay to do it. But if somebody started, let's say my view is that it's not scarce, but your view is it's going to be scarce in about a week. And what you do is you start setting up places on the ocean near Antarctica. God bless you. You'd be the first one there. So individuals would decide that, but that's a very good question. Thanks. I got to go. My time is up. Thanks for your attention.